Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by retired detective Stephen Keogh, who was a DI in the Metropolitan Police, and he spent 30 years at Scotland Yard, and 15 of those years he spent investigating murders. He's written a fantastic book called Murder Investigation Team, and he joins me today to discuss how the British police investigate murders and how that's different from popular fiction and also how murders are investigated in America. Just before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies, and depending on which level you pick, you'll get a free coaster or coffee cup. And also you'll get access to our Patreon exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out twice a month after every espresso martini. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Stephen, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, for the benefit of the listeners, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your career in the police?
Yeah, so I'm Steve Keogh. I spent 30 years in the police. Mm-hmm. I retired from investigating murder was my last job. I did that for the last 12 years of my career. I retired as a detective inspector. I spent most of my career as a detective. I spent a bit of time dealing with terrorism in sort of the early 2000s. But when I landed on murder investigation, it was like, it always sounds corny when I say this, but it was like my calling. Mm. I found the thing that I was almost born for. I loved it. I really enjoyed investigating murder. So once I got there, I never left. I stayed there to the end of my career.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, you're not the first person to have sort of said that they found a kind of calling with investigating murders. I think there is a sense among murder police, I think across the world, that there's a sense of sort of speaking for the dead and finding justice for people. I don't know if you found that.
Yeah, completely, 100%. Yeah, that's what you're there for. Your motivation is to get justice for that victim and their families. And it's not easy being a murder detective, and it has an impact on you personally in your life, etc. But those times where you get those convictions at court make it all worthwhile. And just to be there for the family, you're never going to get their loved one back. But if you can just give them that, I call it almost a gift of justice for their relative, justice for the person they've lost, but also the ability to then kind of move on in their grieving process. We all lose people, but generally we can move on. But when murder's involved and you've got an outstanding court case, you're in a kind of a limbo, and it's a really difficult place for families to be. And just to be part of being able to help them through that is such a rewarding job.
Yeah. How did you end up investigating murders? And if I may, what was it like investigating death on a daily basis? Because it's not exactly a cheery subject.
Yeah, so I quickly realised in the police what it was that motivated me. And it was essentially catching bad guys. That's what I like doing. I like going after criminals. Even in uniform, I would come on duty and pick my car keys up, go out, and I'd go out on a hunt for criminals. It's just what I really enjoyed. And that kind of drags you down the route of being a detective. So if you're motivated by catching criminals, the natural progression is to become a detective. And if you follow that route further, you're always wanting to catch the more serious criminals. So you start off investigating robberies, burglaries, serious assaults, then sexual offences, shootings, and it's sort of a natural progression, and you can't get any more serious than murder. So it was always going to happen. And it's just a case of when I got there, I just realized, well, actually, yeah, this is, for me, was the pinnacle of my career. And I couldn't really see myself doing anything else. Certainly not getting that job satisfaction doing anything else.
Yeah, no, I bet. So the basis of our chat today is going to be around your excellent book, Murder Investigation Team. Why did you decide to write that book?
I didn't decide to write that book, funny enough. I decided to write a completely different book that morphed into that book.
Yeah.
So when I left the police, well, my intention was, and this hasn't happened and my career has gone in a completely different direction. What my intention was, I think you learn some skills in murder investigation that are completely transferable to business in terms of decision making, problem solving, teamwork, that kind of thing. So I decided, if you're going to, everything I read when I was leaving the police, if you want to position yourself as an expert, write a book. So I started to write the book that address that. So this is what we do in murder investigations, and this is how it can help your business. But it was trying to be two different things. So I was like, well, what I think I should probably do, and no one had ever actually done it, strangely, which I didn't realize at the time, is let's firstly write a book of how murder is investigated. But then it's like, well, people in business aren't going to want to read that. Who's going to read that? So it kind of dragged me down a route where I end up writing for true crime fans. And everything I've done since has followed that. And it was completely accidental. I had no intention of doing things I've done since I retired.
Well, you've done very well. Can you talk to us about the definition of murder and how it's different from homicide?
Yeah, so homicide is like the catch-all for all the offences in relating to unlawful killing. So for instance, you've got murder, manslaughter, corporate manslaughter, manslaughter by diminished responsibility. All these offences come under the umbrella of homicide, whereas murder is a very specific, and murder is essentially, if you intentionally take somebody's life, or if you intend to seriously harm them and they die, you commit murder. That's the basics of it. There's a very wordy definition which I could go through, but it's quite an old world type law, and it refers to the fact it has to be a human being that's taken a breath, and the person has to be sane. It's quite wordy, but essentially, if you intend to kill someone and they die, or if you intend to hurt somebody seriously and they die, you commit murder.
Mm. Yeah, I remember in your book, it is very wordy, the definition. I can't recite it myself, but it was some very strange sort of old language that, and I'm surprised it hasn't sort of been semi-updated, but there we go.
Yeah, I mean, it's common law. So common law has been around since forever, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, can you explain how a murder investigation team is structured and how that differs from the popular depiction of a single detective with a partner investigating a murder?
Yeah, no, I fully understand why they do this, but in fictional crime, they will focus in on a lead detective. Mm. And like you say, they'll probably have a partner with them. I mean, the worst one is Luther. Yeah. I mean, that's the worst TV I've ever seen. I've said that a few times now, so if Idris Elba ever bumps into me, he may punch me on the nose. But murders are investigated by a team.
Yeah.
And a murder investigation team in the UK consists generally of around 25 detectives of all the ranks down from detective chief inspector. So you'd have one detective chief inspector, two detective inspectors, four detective sergeants, yeah, and roughly 18 detective constables. And their jobs are all very different. So I use an analogy of a car. So in a car, the engine that drives it, that makes the car work, they're the detective constables. They're the ones that do the actual, what we would consider detective work, the arrests, searches, interviews, speaking to witnesses. That's the detective constables. Detective sergeants, I refer to them as like the pedals. So they're regulating the engine, making sure it's working properly. And the DIs and the DCIs are like the steering wheel. They're sitting up top, saying which direction the car's going to go in. So that's what the analogy I like to use. So that's not portrayed in fiction. And I do understand why, because it would get very confusing if you were reading a crime novel and you had 25 different characters all doing different things. It would be very confusing. So I can understand why they distill it down into a couple of people. But the reality is it's a team of detectives all with their own tasks within a murder investigation, but then all sort of coming together where team meetings, etc., are really important, bringing everything they found together so to build up that case against the killer.
The only TV shows that come to mind I feel have done a reasonable job of depicting it from what you describe would be Prime Suspect, which is a bit old now, and then that Martin Clune's Manhunt. I don't know if you've seen that one. I don't know what your thoughts are on it.
I've not seen Manhunt, but I mean, it's based on Colin Sutton's book, isn't it? So you would expect that to be more realistic, and that's not actually fiction. It's a what I don't know what you would call that. It's a docu.
Yeah, it's a sort of docu. Well, it's a sort of a dramatized. Yeah, it's a real life sort of drama of a. Yeah, it's a drama around a real life situation.
Yeah. So I get it. I do understand that the readers need to be more focused on the story rather than trying to understand. I mean, I don't read anything to do with crime. I read Game of Thrones. I love the Game of Thrones books.
Yeah.
And George R. R. Martin loves a character. So sometimes it's very difficult trying to keep up with who all the different people are, where they fit in.
Yeah.
So, that's one thing on a George R. R. Martin book. You don't need to be doing that on a crime fiction novel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose that's one interesting question that comes to my mind is how... You're investigating, obviously, dark things on a daily basis. Are there any things that you've done personally? Like, you mentioned you watch Game of Thrones, The Void, crime fiction. Are there ways of coping? Do you turn to, like, other fiction that's otherworldly as a way of coping with that?
I'm not sure if it's coping as much as when you're invested all... When you're investigating a murder, it takes over your life. So you're already spending long hours at work anyway, but you can't switch off when you get home. Certainly at those early stages where the case hasn't been solved and you're trying to think of all the avenues that you could go down and what am I missing? What could we do? Who could we... There's so many different things running through your mind. So when you get home and you're with your family, even though you're interacting with your family and your kids, it's still there in your mind. You go to bed, you're still thinking about it. So for me, the escapism of watching something that was... So I would watch science fiction or Game of Thrones, something, or a zombie thing, something that's taking you so far out of the world that you're always in that you can forget about it. The last thing I would want to do is switch a telly on and watch someone else investigate a murder. I couldn't think of anything worse. You need to get away from that.
So you're not an Inspector Morse fan then?
Definitely not, no.
So going through your book, can you talk to us about the importance of crime scenes and how they are processed and what a murder investigation team is trying to establish from them? Because obviously in fiction, we sometimes see people just dress in their regular clothes. But from what I understand, you'd obviously have to wear protective suits and things like that when investigating a murder.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, Chris. That's one of the things I find the hardest when I'm watching TV is what you often see as well. So that you'll have the forensic team in there and we call it full barrier clothing. So a paper suit, mask, gloves, overshoes, etc. They're all in there correctly, as they should be. And then the detective will walk in a suit and see a gun or something, pick it up with a pen that he's just been chewing 10 minutes before. Yeah. And I understand why, because the last thing they want is people getting confused who's who, because they've all got these masks on and they can't tell who it is. There's a good scene in the film Hot Fuzz where... What's his name? Simon Pegg goes into a scene and his girlfriend's there and he's talking to a man because he doesn't know who he is. So I can get that completely. You wouldn't know who's who with those suits on. So I can see why they do it. But from a detective's point of view, when you're watching that, it grates on you. It really does. Mm. So crime scenes, forensics are so important nowadays to murder investigations. Fingerprints, DNA, blood pattern analysis. There's so much can be drawn from a crime scene. So essentially what you're trying to do is you need to keep that crime scene as the integrity of it is so important. That's why as soon as a murder happens, an area is cordoned off. And the only people that would go in there are those that are wearing that full barrier clothing and only those that need to be in there. And the reason being, it's very easy to introduce DNA into a scene. It's very easy to bring it out. You can destroy evidence. And what you're trying to do, you're trying to recreate as much as you can from that crime scene to tell you the story of what has happened, who has been here, what has happened in this murder, not just how someone died, but the circumstances around it. Was there a fight? were they interacting in a way that could lead us to identify them? For instance, were they drinking? Were they in a particular position where we could target our forensic examinations? So the integrity of the scene is so important for that. And as soon as somebody goes in and starts to destroy it, you're losing your evidence. It makes it harder at court to get a conviction because the defense will then start to attack your evidence saying, well, look, somebody else has brought this DNA in, etc. So I always refer back to Luther. I saw this scene, and it was he walked into a crime scene. For some reason, it was a dead dog. I didn't watch the whole of the episodes. I don't know why the dog was dead, but he walked in and he had a junior, his partner, with him. He was a sergeant or something, and he was in his suit, and that exact same scenario. Everyone else is in the full burial clothing. Luther walks in and he says to his partner, "You might want to keep your hands in your pockets, i.e., so you don't touch anything." And I'm thinking, mate, you just walked through blood. You're then going to be 10, 20 minutes later, you're going to be walking into the suspect's house with blood from that dog on your shoes.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Forensic examination of that house is going to suggest that the suspect has been at this crime scene because there's blood there. But you brought it there yourself. So it's that kind of thing. As soon as you don't follow the rules, the defense will just absolutely rip apart any case you build. And that's what I look at and get frustrated about.
Yeah, I can imagine that. One other thing that popped in my mind as well as you're chatting was I was intrigued by, you talked a little bit about some like your techniques of like understanding a crime scene. So one of the ones was you talked about standing in a doorway of a room and sort of scanning to see what was should be there and shouldn't be there. And also going back to the crime scene, like a day or two afterwards, at the same sort of time the murder took place. And everything you want to sort of talk about that.
Yeah. So I am a big fan of standing still. It may sound stupid, but so many detectives don't do this. They're rushing around, they're caught up. Just stand still, just for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Just tell people, just leave me alone and just look. And I call it seeing, not looking. So you're not just looking into a room. You're seeing what is this room telling me? Is there something that's moved? Is there something that's out of place? Can I build up a picture in my own mind about what's gone on just by trying to take in what the room's telling me? And it may sound really simple, but very few detectives actually do that. And not just inside the scene, but outside the scene, when you stood there and you've just arrived. And one of the things that you need to, I suppose experience helps with this, what you need to do is just calm yourself down, sort of, because when you turn up at a murder scene, when you're the first there from the murder team, and you are basically taking responsibility for this murder, everybody's looking at you for advice to bring calmness to what is generally quite a chaotic scene. You've got there on blue lights and sirens, so your adrenaline's running anyway. You know that any decision you make is going to be pored over by lawyers later on. So there's loads of pressure on you. And quite often what you'd see is, I'm not saying running around like headless chickens, but they're not far off it. Some detectives, because that pressure's really getting to them. What you need to do is just recenter yourself, just stand, and just even if people are bothering you, you say, look, can you just give me 2 minutes? And just look around the scene, just looking up and at the floors, looking high, looking at windows, looking for potential routes for a suspect, potential evidence that may have been less. Where would witnesses be? Are there CCTV cameras? Really trying to take in the scene so that you can investigate it properly. And it's something that most detectives don't do. And for me, I always found it such a valuable exercise. And revisiting the scene as well, because when you are there and you've got the cordon tape up, loads of police officers, members of the public there filming you, trying to get a look at what's going on, there's all that chaos. You don't really get a picture of that scene, that area. So go back when everyone's gone and you can get back there and you can get an understanding of, well, what is normal for this area. And again, it's not a lot of detectives do that. And I think it's so important. If you're going to understand and try and solve a murder, you need to try and understand what has gone on and build up a picture of, well, what is normal in this area? What would normally be happening? And you don't get that from that chaotic time at the beginning when the murder's just been reported.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you talk to us about how a murder investigation is run and what investigative thinking is?
Essentially, what you've got is 25 detectives all running around doing their own thing.
Yeah.
But they're all with the same goal in mind. I call it big goal, little goal. So the big goal in a murder investigation is to secure a safe and proper conviction. Not just any conviction. You need to secure the conviction of the person that's done it. So that's what everybody's working towards. But they've all got little goals that feed into that. So if you're on the CCTV, your goal is I need to collect CCTV in this particular area to identify movements of the suspect, movement of the victim, putting them together, whatever it is. But your small goal feeds into that bigger goal, and everybody's doing that. So that's how a murder investigation works. Investigative thinking really is about trying to get an understanding of, so what do we know, what don't we know, and how are we going to find what we don't know? So what do we know, what don't we know, and how are we going to find what we don't? And that's to me is what the investigative thinking is. And as a senior officer, this sort of thought process would all be put down onto paper. So every decision you're coming to, you can justify why you're doing it. You can justify what lines of inquiry you're doing. And just as importantly, what lines of inquiry you're not doing. Because later on, when you get to court, the defense love to try and pick you up on processes. And if for some reason there's something, I've had it where they'll come up with some CCTV should have been found in this area. And if you'd looked there, you'd have seen my client. Well, we had no reason to look there. There was nothing, there was no evidence, no information that anybody at that area had anything to do with the murder. And because you can explain your process for collecting the CCTV, you can knock that one back and say, well, that, yeah, you can say what you like, but this is why we collected the CCTV, what we did. So there's so much thought has to go into what you do, what you don't do, in order to justify it later on. What is important as well, because you've got 25 detectives all running around. Everybody needs to know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And that's it. This is what at the beginning when I was talking about translating skills to business. I think it's that ability to have so many people doing so many different things, but bring them all back together. Everybody understands where their small piece fits into the bigger picture. Understanding what other people are doing and how their work relates to yours. It's really important. And I think in business, that would really, really help.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How does one avoid allowing confirmation bias and sort of poor decision-making to derail investigation?
Yeah, I mean, confirmation bias for me is the number one enemy of a detective. Mm. It's where things can go really wrong. And whenever I talk about this, I always use the example of Rachel Nickell, where Colin Stagg, the police investigating Rachel's murder, had a criminal profiler who came up with a profile of the likely suspect. And as far as the police were concerned, that was Colin Stagg. And they did everything they could to try and prove that they were right. Not prove that he was the killer as in he was the killer, but prove that they were right.
Yeah.
Because they'd already made up their minds. So they went looking for evidence to prove themselves right, including a honey trap and trying to get him to confess to the murder. But it wasn't him. He was innocent, completely innocent. It was somebody else. And where they were so caught up in trying to prove Colin Stagg as guilty, they took their eye off the ball as to who really was the killer. That turned out to be a man called Robert Napper, who then went on to kill a woman and her young child after Rachel. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that's the police's fault, but there is a chance, isn't there? If they hadn't been so caught up in Colin Stagg, could they have got to Napa first? And would Jasmine Blissett and her young child still be alive? Samantha Blissett and her young child still be alive today? And that's to me is like the real sort of the pinnacle of what could go wrong when confirmation bias creeps into your investigation. Mm. So for me, the way you combat that is just being aware that it's a thing. And so I've come up with sort of a mnemonic that to help make better decisions, and it's DICOP. And so for me, it's define goal, information, confirmation bias, options, and prepare to be wrong. So first off, why am I making this decision? What is my purpose? And that's a defined goal. And I think one of the things when I see people making bad decisions is because they're not focusing on why they're making a decision. They're not understanding where they need to end up. That's why they end up making bad decisions. information. Why am I making this decision? What do I know? What don't I know? Information. Confirmation bias. Just be aware of it. If you're aware of confirmation bias and you're aware you could fall into that trap, you're much more likely not to. And you're thinking, right, well, okay, I think this, but what if I'm wrong? And that also goes into the last one, and options. So when you're making a decision, it should never be a binary choice. It shouldn't be A or B. There's always another option. And quite often, if you put your mind to what the other option is, it's almost a compromise of the two. And quite often is actually the better choice because you've thought about the downside to this and the downside to that. If I incorporate that into a different decision, different option, I'm probably going to come up with a better one. And the final one is prepared to be wrong. What if I'm wrong? What if I get this wrong? This decision. What if I get it wrong? What are the repercussions? And if you have that thought process of why am I making this decision? What don't I know? What do I need to know? Let's have a mind on confirmation biased. What are my options and not just two? And what if I'm wrong? And if you think about a decision like that, you've got a much better chance of making a better decision at the end.
Thank you for that. One other question has popped in my mind. You just mentioned profiling and profilers. Do you place much stock in criminal profiling?
I think it can be useful for certain things. So, we rarely use them. So over 100 murder investigations, we use them two or three times, I think. What they are is a best guess of the type of person you're looking for based on previous crimes and academic study. And so what do you do with that? So it can help you in terms of if you're trying to prioritize the people you're looking at. So if you've got a murder and you've got potentially 100 people that could fit your search parameters, if you like, for who you're looking for the murder, so which could include people that were close by, people that was the last people that saw the victim, people they're regularly in contact with, people they may have issues with, and people in the area that have similar MO. So you could end up in some murder inquiries with 100 people on a list that you need to try and eliminate. If you've got a criminal profile, it can help you prioritize them because they're right. If the likelihood is that the character is ABC, let's look at people first that fit ABC, but you don't eliminate them all the others because of a profile. So they have their place, but in reality, they're not going to solve a case for you. They're going to assist you in probably sifting through a number of people, and it's probably as high as it can go.
I've always found profiling quite interesting because obviously I think from a film and TV perspective, we get a bit obsessed about this idea of getting into the mind of a killer. And I think, profiling does tend to get a bit overhyped a little bit.
on my second book, so the first book was Murder Investigation Team, How Killers Are Caught. And the second book, Murder Investigation Team, Jack the Ripper. And essentially what I'm doing, I'm applying the all the processes from the first book to the Jack the Ripper case and trying to see where we end up with it. And I had a really interesting input from the National Crime Agency. So in the UK, there are only two people that are qualified and can provide criminal profiles to the police. And one of those provided a criminal profile for Jack the Ripper for me for the book. And it was a real privilege and it was quite humbling that they chose to do that because the National Crime Agency have never gone public with the work they do around that. So that was a really interesting process to see. But in all honesty, it didn't take us any closer to identifying who Jack the Ripper may have been. It just demonstrated that if the police at the time had this information, they may have been able to prioritise the huge number of suspects that they had.
I have to ask now, did you ever figure out who Jack the Ripper may have been?
I'll give you a clue. No one knows. Don't want to spoil the book, but no one's got a clue. And no matter how many names people come up with, no. When you look at the evidence that's available, there is none. There's a few witnesses that give some really generic descriptions, and beyond that, there is no evidence. So if you're basing it off of evidence, we're never going to know.
No. Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Sorry.
That's all right. Well, back to murder. Can you talk to us a little bit about the sort of different types of motivations for murder?
Yeah. So when I was writing this book, I mentioned about I was going to have to direct it towards true crime fans. went to a couple of Facebook groups because I just wanted to understand what they wanted to know. So I just introduced myself and I put a survey out. Got really good response, like 650 respondents. It was a really good response. And far and away, the number one question that people wanted to know is, why do people kill? So I thought, well, I better put my mind to this. And I've got quite an analytical mind. And I was like, well, is there some kind of pattern? Is there something I can say, well, look, murders happen in it for these reasons? And at first, I've got to be honest, I was struggling with that. It was like trying to understand, well, how do they all fit in? And then I thought I'd come at a different angle. Rather than thinking about why as people do we choose to kill, I was trying to, I came at a different angle, was why as people are we motivated to do anything? Why do we choose to do anything in life? And when I came at that angle, I had a light bulb moment. I was like, actually, there's only three reasons as human beings we do anything. And that's because of how we feel. What something, I've got some feeling inside of me that's motivating me to do something. So if we relate that to the gym, I feel tired, I feel lethargic, or I could feel inspired by watching something on TV, but I feel something that's made me want to go to the gym. Or we do it because of how we want to feel. So if I do something, I know it's going to make me feel like this. And again, if we relate that to the gym, it could be that I know when I work out, I get a rush of endorphins, or I beat my personal best, or I get a glow after I've done it or something. But I know if I go to the gym, this is how it's going to make me feel. And the third one is for gain, for the benefit that you're going to get from it. So if I go to the gym, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to have that beach body. I'm going to sleep longer, going to live longer. So no matter what you do, in that scenario for a gym, it will fall under them, how I feel, how I want to feel, and the benefit I get. And that will translate to anything that you choose to do, including murder. And it was like a light bulb moment for me. It's like, it just makes complete sense. So how I feel, so anger, jealousy, disrespect, any like really strong emotion that's been triggered within you because of some kind of event, they all fall under that. And I think what we're doing when we're describing, if imagine if someone comes home and they find their partner in bed with somebody else and they end up killing them, and you ask them, well, why did you do that? I don't think they would even be able to describe it, but all they would be able to say, I felt this rage. But what we want to do is label that rage in terms of, was it jealousy, anger, humiliation? In actual fact, I don't think it matters. I think that becomes a case of semantics.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is a triggered emotion, a really strong emotion that covers all of those. And they're all so close that how can you differentiate what the actual emotion is? And then when we're talking about, Jack the Ripper, so this is why he killed. So it's either power, control, sexual gratification, enjoyment. Typical serial killers would come under that. And what they're doing, their act of killing somebody is in order for them to feel something, feel one of those emotions. Domestic violence will come under that as well, where it's all about control and power. I'm hurting you because of it makes me feel powerful. And then the final one, robbery, terrorism, hitman, gang violence. It's all to do with the benefit. I want to achieve something. I want to gain something for me or somebody else. In order to do that, I have to hurt you. And they will fall under that. Now, the only proviso would be if someone's really seriously mentally ill when they're hearing voices or seeing things, hallucinations. But I am yet to see anybody come. I defy you. Like, please come up with a murder that will not come under one of these three headings. And I don't think you can, because ultimately, if you strip away the legal or moral ramifications of murder, it still comes back to a choice somebody is making. I'm going to kill you out of my own choice. It would be because of how I feel, how I want to feel, or the benefit I'll get from it.
Yeah, yeah. What are the most common circumstances for a murder in all the sort of murders that you've investigated? Is there like a particular type of murder that's quite common?
I would say there were three that would probably be the most common, and they were associated with gangs, so gang violence and drugs, mostly knife crime, but the odd shooting, domestic murders, and murders are related to mental illness. So they would be the three most common. Obviously, you could have amongst that, you would have potentially, I don't know, confrontation at a pub. You may have, rarely, but you may have those that are going out to try and kill somebody because of that power and control, sexual gratification. But the majority of murders would have fallen under that. They're associated with gangs, associated with domestic violence or as a result of someone's mental health.
Mm. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. Can you talk about some of the different lines of investigation, murder investigation teams pursue?
So all murders have exactly the same lines of inquiry. Some yeah. may have, there might be a few differences. Like, so for instance, it's all about criminal profiles. You wouldn't get them in all murders. But there are certain lines of inquiry that happen in every single murder. So so CCTV, telephones, forensics, intelligence, family liaison officer. And these will all be allocated to different officers on the team. Every single murder will have those, but different murders will rely on them in different ways. So one murder investigation might be quite CCTV heavy because it's in the middle of a built-up area. But if it's happened in a rural area, CCTV will still be relevant, but it won't be relied on as much. And it's the same for telephones, forensic evidence, etc. So when you begin a murder inquiry, an officer will, or there will always be an officer allocated, we call it core roles, that core role. Every single murder, that an officer will be allocated that core role. They may be busier on some than others, but every single murder follows those same patterns. And it's not murder investigation isn't like painting by numbers. There is no book that you can open up and tell you how to investigate a murder, but there certainly are patterns that you follow in every single murder investigation.
Yeah, if I remember the Colin Sutton show with regards to the investigation into Millie Dowler, I think it was, that they, at least it was depicted in the show, I'm not 100% sure how it stacks up reality, but there was a particular van that was adjacent to the one of the crime scenes that they ended up focusing on, but it was a very common type of van. They didn't really apparently have the full number plate, but that sort of became the thing that they focused on, even though a lot of people sort of challenged that. So obviously you're saying investigations, sometimes something will come up, will end up being the focus, is that right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so every single murder is different. But then that van, CCTV officers will be looking to try and establish the movements of the van, try and see if they can identify. And CCTV would incorporate AMPR. Does AMPR, can that give an indication of that type of van in that area? So every single murder will have different nuances to it, but they all will fall under an umbrella of a particular line of inquiry.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we found our suspect. So can you talk to us about a sort of arrest and interviewing a suspect? And also, how important is it to get a confession?
Yeah, see, this is something that I think is misunderstood, certainly from crime fiction. When you're interviewing a suspect, it's not to get a confession. And in reality, it's rare, that, especially when you're interviewing someone for murder, it's rare that they're going to confess. Mm. What you're trying to do, ideally, is get them to commit to an account that you can test. And it also makes it a bit more difficult for them when they come to court, because they've already come up with an account at the police station. And if they later come up with something that's different, or they've clearly been lying at the police station, or there might just be slight differences, that makes it much harder for them when they're given evidence at court. And the differences will be pointed out to them when they're given evidence. Well, you're saying this now, but you said something different back then. And then the jury can make up their mind as to whether or not that's because they're lying. So you're trying to get them to commit to a story. The reality is the vast majority of people you interview will say no comment. When I was interviewing terrorists, they wouldn't even say that. They just wouldn't even talk to you. They would just basically look at the floor. They wouldn't even answer their name. So, I mean, that on its own, if someone's saying no comment as well, that's not the worst thing in the world, because under the law in England and Wales, if you are interviewed and you get that caution, those words that you're given after you're arrested, you get those same words when you're being interviewed in a police station, which is you do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something that you later rely on in court.
Yeah.
Anything you do say may be given evidence. And it's that middle bit that's important, something which you later rely on in court. So if they come up with something there, the judge, and they usually would do this in a murder trial, can direct the jury that that defendant could have, what he's telling you now, members of the jury, he or she could have told you back at the police station, and you can draw an inference from that, and that potentially of their guilt. And I remember this, I served this case at court, and this little old lady from the jury came up to me afterwards. She said, "Oh, thank you, officer, for all your help." She said, "I knew he was guilty as soon as he didn't say anything at the police station." it was a really nice insight into how a jury mind works. Oh, I think she thinks that, many more must think that. Because it's right, it really isn't it? If you're innocent, you could just say back then, say, "Look, I've got nothing to do with it. Why wait until 9 months, a year later?" Mm. So interviewing people isn't quite like it is on telly, because rarely will they confess, and that's not actually what you're looking to do.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, I can see why people in TV definitely want the kind of art of the confession, because it helps, makes the detective on TV look good, I suppose, isn't it? Because you kind of get information out of them and have an interesting kind of conversation about the motives of why they did what they did.
Yeah, and funnily enough, you saying that, I'm only guessing by looking at the body language of the jury members, I always got the impression they were quite disappointed with interviews, police interviews, because I think they were expecting the banging on the table and the tricking them and getting them to confess to it. I think the reality, especially nowadays, there's different types of interview training, and so you've got tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier one, all police officers, all uniform officers are taught tier one interview training. Detectives are given tier two training, and advanced interviewers tier three. And when you're interviewed by a tier three trainer, it can be quite dull. I mean, they go into so much detail, and I think it can be counterproductive when you get to court, because the jury just nod off, because they just the interviewing officer will be reading out a transcript of the interview in the witness box, and they could be there for 2 days. And if there was anything interesting, the jury have ignored it because they're just not even listening anymore. So I think it can be counterproductive. And I think, I think jury members would probably prefer it if it was like it is on TV.
Well, we'll move to the Old Bailey. I once went to the Old Bailey in 2011, just as a member of the public to watch a murder trial, because I'd never seen one before and was just intrigued. And what the two observations I had were, it was a lot slower than I was expecting it to be. And I vaguely remember I think it must have been the prosecution gave a quick speech about forensics versus CSI and how to set your expectations. So it was quite an interesting experience going into a court. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a bit about then taking a murder case, and in London it would be the Old Bailey, wouldn't it? And how a kind of murder case would play out. And in your book, you mentioned a bit about how the experience for the families can be quite a negative one sometimes.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot to say there, so I'll try and keep it brief. Yeah, murder trials aren't as you would see on TV. They can be very slow, and if you're a jury member, I mean, one of the things when you get called up for jury service, you're basically told you're going to do 2 weeks, and I've had cases there, and we know they're probably going to be 3 months. And the faces of the jury when they're told that this could be 3 months, and you can see the panic on their face, and they're going up to the judge when they, because what happens is you get, I don't know, 20, 30 members of the jury from the jury room brought down, potential jurors, and randomly their names get caught out, and you can see them, please don't call me, or if they're retired and they've got no other commitments, then maybe they do want to be called, and then you can see the panic on their face, and the judge will always say, once your name's called out, go to the jury box. But if you've got any reason why you can't commit to this trial, come to me. And you see them running up to the judge. I can't do it. I mean, which is quite reasonable. Can you imagine having been told you've got to put your life on hold for 3 months for a jury? So eventually you'll get there. Eventually you'll find 12 members of the public that can do it. And they can be long. They can be slow. It can be really frustrating if you're a jury member, because you're always getting told to leave because there's something interesting that needs to be discussed that you can't hear it.
Yeah.
And for, as a murder investigator, I didn't enjoy it. I've got to be honest. I didn't enjoy the process of the trial. I enjoyed the end. Getting a conviction at the end was the best part of the job, massively the best part of the job. But when you're putting your prosecution case, it can get quite nasty. Defense barristers, I've got no issue with defense barristers, because if I were ever to be charged with something, I would want to be defended. But the way in which some of them go about their business is, in some cases, is despicable. So the way they would treat sometimes family members when they're given evidence, just as a background about the victim, sometimes the way these barristers treated the families was awful. And the court system is set up to look after the defendant. I get that. I fully understand we need a fair system. But there's too much, not too much emphasis, but there's a huge gap between the emphasis that's played on towards the defendant and victims, families, witnesses, etc. And it's it can be a really hard time for families. And they will go in and the defense will try and undermine they would try and turn the jury against the victim, try and demonize the victim, trying to almost paint it that it's the victim's fault that they're dead. And that can be really difficult for a family when they're hearing that their loved one just they're having their reputation completely ruined in court. It's a really hard time for the family members. And that's why I always made it sweeter by the end when you get that conviction. So when you've been through the case, when you've been through your evidence, when the defense have put their case and all the speeches are done, the summing up has been done by the judge, the jury will go out and they can be out for days. And eventually you get called back into the court and you know that there's going to be a verdict. And you'll sit there and it's a really nervous time. I was nervous enough. God knows what the defendants feel like. My stomach will be churning, the families. And the first people I would always look at when the verdict came back was the families, just to see their reaction. And you would have seen me write about that in the book, Chris, that I was always blown away by the dignity that these families always constantly showed. And even when the conviction was read out, as when the verdict come back as a guilty, there was never like this joyous moment. It was like a moment of relief. And as I talked about earlier, they're in this limbo, and to them it's like they can start, it's like there's a light at the end of the tunnel that they can start to move on. So the court, I don't, there's one of the things I really really don't miss is court. But I do miss that feeling at the end, that when you get everything that you've been through, the family, you and everyone's been through, that conviction at the end is why I stayed in the end and did the 12 years.
Yeah, I could imagine that. It's, getting all that work, sort of you're putting all that work together, and at least there's a successful outcome from your point of view.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I've got a few more questions, if I may, just before we sort of wrap up. And so one of the first questions is, are all investigations treated equally?
So this is a two-tier answer. So
yeah.
In terms of the murder investigators, the investigation team, 100%, you would never treat one murder over, you would never prioritize one murder over another. Sometimes you get more emotionally attached to a murder. For me, it was when it was children and you become more emotionally invested. But in terms of professional investment, the time you put into it and the effort you put into solving the case, you don't differentiate. Every case you treat the same. And every case you try your 100% best to solve. But organisationally, murders are treated differently. So for instance, the murders are categorised as category A, category B, category C. So a category C murder is where the identity of the suspect, the killers, is known or believed. Category B is where they're not known, they're unknown. We don't know who's done it. We used to call them a whodunit.
Yeah.
Or if it's a really, really tricky one, we call it a proper whodunit. They're like, so it's yeah, either a whodunit or a proper whodunit. But a category A murder, those kind of murders where has a real impact on the community, the reputation of the police, there's real public interest. So for instance, Sarah Everard's murder would have been a category A. And there's no doubt that those category A murders do get access to more resources. And I remember when Sarah Everard's case was going on and we had a murder of a young boy was shot and his mum was saying, why can't we have those? Because you can see on the news how many resources that put into it. And she's saying, why can't we have that on our murder? And you wish you could. You wish you could provide those resources on every single murder, but it's just not possible. So you've got to say, look, we get that, we fully understand that, but you've got our full and utter commitment, and I suppose that's the best you can promise. But yeah, so that's it really. Essentially, as a detective, no. As an organisation, yes, there is a difference between murders.
Mm, Just quickly, you mentioned the Sarah Everard case. Obviously, in the UK, that was a very high-profile case, and obviously it involved a police officer named Wayne Cousins. Do you have any thoughts or insights on that that you could share with us?
In terms of why he did it? What was he?
Yeah, sort of why he did it. And also, there were other events that led up to him killing her that seemed to go undetected. I don't know if you've got any sort of thoughts on all of that.
Yeah, so earlier on when I was talking about the motivations for kill, motivations that people kill, his is a pull of emotion. And it's almost like textbook. You talk about the progression of somebody who's sexually motivated, and he did the flashing. There was allegations of him flashing, and I would imagine in between the flashing and the murder of Sarah, there were probably things in between that we don't know about. But undoubtedly, he was doing what he was doing because he wanted to feel something by hurting Sarah. And you could see from the planning that he was buying things off of the internet to prepare to do this, that was his intention. That's the basics of it. That's why he was doing it, why he did it, and how he thought he would get away with it. What would possess a police officer to do that? I would never be able to get my head around, never be able to understand. I understand why he did it in terms of what was motivating him, but that's a big leap from understanding the basics of it to understanding why he actually then went and did it. And he had such a negative impact. The public perception of the police, I think, has probably never been lower. And him and the rapist, what's his name? Dave. I can't remember his name now. Anyway, there was one that was convicted of multiple rapes. Mm. And you're just continually getting these put in the news is completely undermining the confidence in the police. And what made me really sad at that time was, if you went on social media, you would see women who would genuinely, not the type of women that would normally go on media and dig out the police. Women would genuinely had concerns that if something were to happen to me, I wouldn't feel comfortable calling the police. And that made me really sad because that's been my job. The job of the police is to protect society. That's basically why they're there, to protect society. And if something as bad is happening to you, you should have the confidence, and the police should be the first people that you would want to seek that help from. And that seed of doubt that has been sown by Wayne Cousins and Carrick, isn't it? Dave Carrick. That just makes me feel quite sad, because that's been my whole adult life, has been devoted to protecting society, and the thought that people at their most vulnerable would have concerns about seeking the help of police. It's just a really awful position to have found ourselves in.
Yeah, no, it's very sad. It does feel like, unfortunately, at the moment, trust in the police has gone to an all-time low, and I feel social media exaggerates that a little bit as well and makes it worse.
But then the police don't hurt themselves today.
No, because every day there's a new scandal. There's
something else.
Sort.
Yeah. And I strongly believe that it's down to the police now to rebuild that trust, and they've got to be seen to be getting their house in order.
Yeah, definitely. Another murder question, because I know we're getting a bit close to the end of the time there, but I'm really interested also about, like, are there some instances where MIT are not the lead in a murder inquiry? Because I asked this because I've seen Counterterrorism Command occasionally lead investigations into, like, for example, the attempted murder of the Skripals, or we could say attempted assassination in 2018. How does that work, and do they have officers in their ranks who have a background in murder investigations?
Yeah, so essentially, if a murder appears to be motivated by terrorism, it will be led by SO15, the Counterterrorism Command. Mm. So we were on call murder team, and we were covering Lee Rigby's area, and they took it on straight away because it clearly was motivated by terrorism. And they have some highly experienced officers there, and they're fully capable of investigating murders. And in actual fact, they have so many more resources than we do. One of the last murders I investigated was the murder of Matt Ratana. He was a police officer, was shot in custody in Croydon.
We
went to the Counterterrorism Command to assist us with a lot of that, because they just have a vast amount of resources compared to a murder team. Mm.
Yeah. I remember that case. That's a terrible one. Because that was one where the suspect still had a gun on him. Is that right?
Yeah, they searched him when he was on the street, but they didn't find that he had a gun in a holster just under his arm.
Mm, oh, dear. Yeah. Well, one last question, because I know we're running out of time. What makes a good murder detective?
For me, the number one skill of a murder detective is communication. So your job as a murder investigator is to gather information in order to prove a case against the killer. And a lot of the information you're going to be seeking is within people, within witnesses, within suspects, victims' family. And it's not always easy getting that information out of people. One, they might not want to tell you. Two, they don't always understand what's important, and they might only tell you what they think's important. So being able to communicate with people and get that information, and certainly when you're dealing with the people you come across in a murder inquiry, there could be people that hate you, that are angry, that mistrust of the police. There could be people that think they're above you because of their status in society. So there's all sorts of different people and everyone in between, and you're trying to communicate with. So you have to be able to adjust how you communicate with someone, use techniques that can get that information from them even when they don't want to give it to you. So yeah, the number one skill in a murder investigator has to be communication.
Yeah. Steve, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you, your book, and your work?
Yeah, so I've got my own website, stevekeogh.com. Currently, I'm putting all my efforts into helping crime writers. So I've launched an online community. My podcast is coming out. So I think there's a real gap in where people who are writing crime fiction can go and get proper information. Sometimes you get writers that are successful will get earn more money at getting a book than writing a book than I did, who can afford to go to get private coaching or information from a former police officer or something. But most authors can't do that. So I'm just trying to provide some accessible information to really try and help crime writers with their authenticity. So that's what my project is at the moment. And everything I do is on stevekeogh.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for your time today. It's been really great chatting with you.
Cheers, Chris. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.